Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
Welcome, everybody, to Parshas Vayechi, 5772, back from the winter break. We've got one parsha left in the book of Bereishis. This year we are studying sources, we're studying texts. I will try my best to get a connection to the parsha, but you know me, that's not necessarily my goal to gain a deeper understanding of the parsha. It's to gain a deeper understanding, period, of something important. And this week, I have something on tap which I want to share with you. I had taken with me on my trip up to Baltimore a Xerox copy of an essay, a lecture that had been given by Rav Dessler on Hanukkah. Mm. And it was so eye-opening to me. And as I thought about it more and more, I realized that it explains a lot, and especially a lot of things that we've talked about in this class over the last couple years. I don't know if you remember, but I made a comment a couple weeks ago that we have a challenge because in our day and age, everyone's looking at everything in the external, in the chitzonius mode, in the surface or external mode, rather than in the pneumius, in the internal mode. And Dr. Schultz, who's very, very thoughtful, says, what do you mean by external and internal? And I started to give an answer, and then I realized, you know, I use those terms a lot because I've heard them a lot, and they seem to be important, but what does it really mean? And Rav Dessler speaks about it, and I realized that really we have to compartmentalize what we're talking about when we're talking about external and internal. So, Baruch Hashem, I have something to present to you. It's maybe just the beginning, but a deeper understanding of this this concept of chitzonius and pnimius, externality and internality. The primary text will be in the third section from Michtav Me'Eliyahu, Rav Dessler's writing. But what I'd like to do really is try to define this on three different applications. First of all, and the connection to the parsha comes in the first. The first is chitzonius and pnimius in the Torah. And we have a great example of that in the words of Yaakov to Yosef, quoted here in 48:22. I'll kind of read the Hebrew. This is when Yaakov is on his deathbed and he calls Yosef and asks him to bring his son so they can be blessed. This is before he blessed all the other brothers. And in the last verse of that whole episode, Yaakov states, "Va'ani nosati lecha shechem achad alachecha asher lo kachti miyad ho'emori becharbi uvekashti." As for me, I have given you Shechem, one portion more than your brothers, which I took from the hand of the Amorite with my sword and with my bow. As Rashi understands it, in this interpretation at least, Yosef was going to receive some extra land in his portion, and that was going to be of the land that was Shechem. That was the city that was conquered, that was invaded by Yaakov's sons, Shimon and Levi, after a man, the prince, had abducted Dina. Now, so I captured that land, and I'm going to give it to you eventually in the back when your tribe comes into the land of Israel. And Yaakov says, where did I get that land from? I took it from the hands of the Amorite with my sword and with my bow. Now, sword and bow are two armaments used in battle. But Rashi says, in a rather well-known interpretation, and he's quoting the Talmud, that sword and bow here are allegories. Sword refers to sharp wisdom, and bow refers to prayer. I just saw a footnote in the Art Scroll Rashi edition where one of the sages said that the word bikashti, or uvikashti, and with my bow, if you change the vowels, can be read as uvakashasi, and my request. A bakasha is a request. So, bicharbi, uvikashti.
That's in the parsha this week.
Yeah. Yeah. Dr. Schultz, I mentioned your name as in the beginning, that you had asked me to clarify the meaning of internal and external in the context I was speaking. And that is going to be the subject of our class today. Bicharbi, oh, you're Vayachi. Oh, yeah. Bicharbi, uvikashti. Okay. So Rashi's interpretation, uvikashti. Now, keshet is keshet is a bow, and bikashti would be with my bow, and uvikashti would be and with my bow. But if you take uvakashati, you could reread it as and my request. But you know what? It that almost trying to rewrite the word almost undermines the point, because what Rashi is telling us over here is that words can be understood on as allegories. You can say that literally it's a bow and it's a sword and a bow. But it doesn't mean, I don't know if Rashi is saying that Yaakov didn't have a sword and a bow, but he's saying that's not all that he had. And that's not all of the reason that he was able to capture this land. So Art Scroll, the Chumash, the stone Chumash in the footnote, brings out this significant point. The use of this simile reveals another aspect of the righteous. To them, strength depends not on armaments and sheer physical force, but on their spiritual strength. So this what it could mean is as follows. I'm just theorizing that really Yaakov went to war and he had a sword and a bow. Yes, he had his sword in his sheath and he had his bow in his quiver. Is it?
His arrow
in his quiver and his bow. And he went to war and he probably drew his sword and he probably shot an arrow or two from his bow. But if you were to ask Yaakov, why did you win that war? How did you overpower this big nation? He would say, because of my sharp wisdom and my prayer. So this is what we are going to refer to as an illustration of chitzonius and pnimius in the Torah. External and internal. Externally is the allegory. And it may be true. It may be actual. Yes, Jacob defeated Shechem with a sword and with a bow. But ultimately there was a greater internal meaning of that. In fact, there is a greater source of strength than the sword and the bow, and that was his wisdom and his prayer.
I might forget it later on.
Go ahead.
I'm a little mixed up because I thought that Shechem, you mentioned Dinah,
was captured by the boys.
And the boys really did the work to get it. And Jacob even criticized them for that.
Right.
So how can we say that he did that? He actually was sitting back. He didn't even participate in that.
That's what I thought too. Rashi says, and I didn't want to get into the whole history of it, I think it was Rashi, or maybe it's been another one, that later on he took that land. What he was criticizing, Shimon and Levi for was the way they went about the guile and the. But later on, he actually conquered that land.
So this is really talking about a later time.
A later time.
Not the Dinah story.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. And I'm sorry, I did see it. It must not be in the Rashi, but unless it was in the footnote. But all right. Now, in this regard, in terms of the external and the internal of Torah, I also remember having seen something. Rambam wrote, you know, the Yad HaChazakah, which is a magnum opus of all the laws, the digest of all the laws in the Oral Torah. But he also wrote a philosophical work called Moreh Nevuchim, Guide to the Perplexed. And just recently, I've never really studied it, just recently this rabbi from Pennsylvania who has worked for many, many years translating some very difficult texts, or I just became aware that he translated Moreh Nevuchim, and a very easy to read one. And one of the main purposes of the Rambam's writing this is to educate people not to take the Torah so darn literally, if you'll pardon my language. I mean, he said this is why idolatry started, because they took everything in the Torah so literally. And he goes to great lengths to show that there is another level of understanding that is required. And one line, I just wanted to excerpt this one line, and he says, think about this. Rambam's words, think about this. The deeper significance of the words of the Torah are the pearls. The literal interpretation of the allegory is meaningless.
Really?
Meaningless. In other words, you know, just take as an example. Yeah, it's important to know the chronology. But if we walk away from reading Chumash and all we say is the literal meaning, it's meaningless. We have failed to grasp the Torah. To use the word meaningless is very strong. I mean, I would have said that, you know, there's deeper and deeper meanings. But to say that just to know the allegory is meaningless is pretty strong. So, anyway, here we have an illustration of what it means on one level, or in one application, that there's external and internal. Now, if it's true in the way we study the Torah, it's my own assumption and my own assertion that it has to be true in the world that Hashem created as well. And this perhaps will get into the context with which I spoke, and Dr. Schultz asked me about it. I said that in our society, we're always looking at the surface, at the externalities of things, and not at the internalities of things. And you asked me, rightfully so, to clarify that. And I realized that I was probably short on understanding myself. And this is what the focus of our class. If you would allow me to read my own words here, in the world. This is all my thoughts, so please don't blame it on anybody else. It should be clear by now, on a basic level, that the distinction between internal and external pervades everything in the world. Just as the allegory is meaningless without its message, so too is a physical object, or aesthetic beauty, meaningless without knowledge of its source or purpose in the grand divine scheme. One who seeks Torah truth and spirituality will attempt to avoid the temptation of getting caught up in the apparent surface of an object or an idea. Instead, using Torah study and mitzvot as his guide, he will search for the message behind the allegory and try to the best of his ability to grasp the true essence of the matter. Is it easy? Of course not. If it was easy, then it wouldn't be a challenge. We are by nature wired to look at something and immediately perceive it with our senses and just take it at face value. And it is only through a specific type of training and a specific type of tradition and teaching that one would even think to look for a deeper meaning. But that, in essence, is what the Torah is here to do. The Torah is here to infuse our senses with a sixth sense, a sixth sense which really redefines what the other senses are experiencing. To me, this is maybe may sound deep, but I think we will be lost as a people in our society if we don't begin to comprehend this and to start to look at things that way. So it starts with the way we learn Torah. We can practice by taking verses and reading verses that we may have just taken as a story or at face value, and look into what Rashi says or what the Talmud says. And it may surprise us, and it may be, we may be very skeptical when we hear, oh, why are the rabbis trying to put words into Yaakov's mouth? Yaakov is just talking about a sword and a bow. Why in the world are we talking about prayers? It's annoying to the person who is not used to looking at something on a different plane. But this is, how else are we going to discover the deeper message of anything if we do not begin with seeking that in the Torah? Okay. These are the first two applications of external and internal. And then we are going to go on to our primary text, which is Rav Dessler, which I was blessed to discover reading over the days of Hanukkah. Are there any questions or comments that you'd like to make at this point?
Where is the word meaningless used? Who said that?
It's the translator's translation of Rambam, of Mora Nevuchim.
Do you remember the word?
I didn't see it in Hebrew. First of all, he didn't write it in Hebrew. He wrote it in Arabic.
Arabic.
And I didn't see the translation into Hebrew, and I also didn't. I just saw the translation. The Rambam starts off by saying, it says in the Torah that man was created in God's image. You know. Oh, so God has an image, does he? God has a body, just like man? You know, he says these are the kinds of things that people the errors that people were making, and it led to idolatry.
Mm-hmm.
So his whole thesis, almost on the book of the Guide to Reflect, is to teach us how to reread the Chumash. And I was very enlightened by that. But okay.
Okay. Well, you know, it's an anthropomorphic, and that was just something to help us.
The reason Rambam wrote the book, Mora Nevuchim, he was trying to correlate Aristotelian logic with Jewish faith.
Uh-huh.
Ah, that logic and faith, which of course is sharper bow and with wisdom and faith and prayer.
Mm-hmm.
He tried to put the two together fairly well. A lot of people liked it, some people didn't.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah,
but the Christians picked it up. And there was a whole group of scholastics that started to put theology and philosophy together.
Mm-hmm.
But that's why he did that. In other words, and of course from the Talmud, I think they say you're supposed to study Torah with the mnemonic again. It's pardes. Pardes?
Yeah.
Shot, simple, remez, what you're hinting at, allusion,
drash,
where you have to dig deeper, and then the secrets that are in that. So all of this corresponds,
This is at the core of their dispute. This is, to use the very flavorful Yiddish word, mamish. This is mamish, really what this class is aimed at piercing the wall between the internal and the external. And let us go on to our next phase, and God willing, this will be a conversation that we will continue to have, okay, because I think we'll have more to say about what you just
Rashi
commented on.
Rashi always used to say, "I'm just going to trick."
I'm telling you the pshat.
It's simple.
Yeah.
But he
and,
doesn't.
But
he
some be, when sometimes because it's sometimes it's impossible.
Yeah, he gets carried.
Sometimes, no, not just he got carried away. Sometimes the Torah cannot be understood on the simple way without bringing in the drash. Mm-hmm. Okay. In ourselves, the internal and the external, this is perhaps the most profound area of where internal and external is brought out. And what I loved about Rav Dessler is that he calls upon many of the concepts that we have been developing. I have been taken by, as you heard me many times, about the different levels of the man, of Adam, you know, the goof, the body, and the nefesh, the soul, the animal soul, and the emotional side, and the intellect, and then the higher neshama. I've been taken by that in trying to get a better grasp of who we are. So, Michtav Me'Eliyahu adds a whole another dimension to this. It is written in the old. Now, who was Rav Dessler? Rav Dessler lived from 1892 to 1953. He started off in Europe. He moved to London, I think, to take care of an aunt. He ended up staying in England and founding the famous Gateshead Kollel, a Torah community. We learned a few weeks back from Rav Schwab. He was the Mashgiach Ruchni in the Gateshead Yeshiva. But years before, Rav Dessler had founded a kollel in Gateshead. And then later on, he was invited to join the faculty at Panovich Yeshiva, then probably the biggest yeshiva in the world, in Bnei Brak, where he lectured until his passing. Rav Chaim Friedlander, who I've quoted many times before, and I personally learned from him, was one of the key students of Rav Dessler. Anyway, it is written in the Holy Sepharim, the Holy Works, which usually means the code word for Kabbalah, that the number 7 represents the level of this world, i.e., the spirituality that can be perceived in our world. Our world means here and now. After the 6 days of creation comes the 7th day, Shabbos, which is called Me'ein Olam Haba, a taste of the world to come, as it is a taste of the spiritual world. Why is it just a taste? Because it's really not the spiritual world. It's this world. But it's a taste of the spiritual world. Shabbos is spiritual, as spirituality can be experienced down in this earthly existence. And it completes the 6 days of creation. In other words, relative to the 6 days of creation, Shabbos is spiritual. But it's the number 7. There is a higher realm represented by the number 8, which is also perceivable in this world. The number 8 represents spirituality that cannot be fully perceived down here. It is in the realm of the world to come itself, that which even prophets were not able to perceive through prophecy. Prophets could not perceive anything beyond their ken. As earthly beings, they could not perceive with prophecy anything other than earthly ideas. Spiritual earthly, but earthly nonetheless. They, for example, prophets could not tell you what it was like in Olam Haba. They couldn't. Because you cannot perceive in this world that which is beyond this world. Rav Dessler explains, by the way, that's why the Torah never mentions Olam Haba. Because it's not in this realm. Now here's the chiddush. Here's the novelty. The Torah, which Hashem revealed to us on Shavuos, is in the realm of 8. It was given after 7 cycles of weeks. Now that means that the Torah is from a different world. The Torah is way beyond our ability to relate to, because it is straight from the mouth of God, so to speak. The Torah is otherworldly. Now, what is bothering you about that?
It was given to us to use.
It was given to us to use down here. In fact, we're studying it right now. In fact, we study it all the time. We read the Torah, we understand it. We may have to probe a little bit deeper to get the deeper meaning, but what do you mean Torah is in the realm of eight and we can't perceive? Why is it any different than Shabbos? So, here's my question. To delve deeper, if Torah is the realm of eight, and we can study Torah just as we keep Shabbos, what then is the difference between our ability to grasp the realm of seven and the realm of eight in this world? We can do both. So what's the big deal about Shabbos, Torah? It's all the same. So Rav Dessler writes further. In the pathway towards understanding, there are two realms. The first is the internal panimi, that which a person grasps within his heart. These are Rav Dessler's words. This realm of understanding is deep, comprehensive, broad, and rings totally true. The second is the external, the external, chitzoni, that which he perceives with his seichel, with his intellect. His intellect is not the same as what's in his heart. This idea became clearer to me before I even saw this when I was in Minneapolis several months ago at a bar mitzvah. And I'm not great when it comes to sense of direction. It takes me a long time to really get to know a place, and I always make wrong turns, and all my kids laugh at me, but it doesn't come naturally to me. I was getting to know the neighborhood and which side do you go to if you want to go to that street, which side do you go out of the house if you want to go to that street. And I was really getting to know it. And then one time I was backing out and I went the wrong way. And they laughed at me again. And I said, you know, that's the difference between intellectual knowledge and really knowing something. I don't have to think about which way to go when I come out of my house. It's just in me. It's in my blood. And the other one, I know intellectually because I figured it out. If I think about it, that this way is the highway and this way is the shul. It's all like up there, but it's not really natural. It's not part of me. Mm-hmm. This is the difference between internal understanding and external understanding. So let's continue on. With internal understanding, a person is able to grasp, very deeply, of course, but he's only able to grasp those things which are in his world, things with which he is connected. But it's internal. In contrast, with external or intellectual understanding, one is able to perceive even those things which are beyond his personal experience. Indeed, a higher spiritual reach. However, he does not readily grasp the internal essence of those things. Rather, he knows them only as external knowledge. This is like one who hears an analogy but does not know its hidden message. Okay, does this make any sense?
Yes.
What this is saying is the following, my dear friends, is that there's two realms. There's that which we know really well, but it's limited because it's only limited to our own experience. We can go beyond our own experience and we can grasp it, but it's not going to be really well. It's almost like these two realms, each one has an advantage and a disadvantage. the advantage of internal knowledge is it's really, really part of you. There are certain things that you do, it was drilled into you from, you know, the day you were a child, that you just say please, thank you, and you clean up after you. And that is something that you would never even think twice about. That is internal knowledge. Why is that internal knowledge? Because you learned it from your parents and your grandparents. And that's really good. When you meet somebody who's got it in their kishkas, you are extremely impressed. You are convinced of their sincerity, of their genuineness. It is real. It's internal. But it's limited. Because the only things you learned from your parents was to say, please, thank you, and clean up after you. They didn't teach you everything. So you go out and you learn other things. What a gift. You have a mind, we have an intellect, and we can soar. We can take out books, and we can read up on so many different topics, and we can hear lectures from so many different perspectives and gain so much knowledge. And that's a great advantage. There's only one disadvantage. It's probably not internal. So we have these two realms. We have internal knowledge, which is great but limited to our experience. We have this external knowledge, which is much farther reaching, but it lacks the internalness. Isn't that great? Isn't that great?
Yep.
Now, that's the end of this piece, but I only do one sheet. But for if you're interested, we have extra notes. It's not part of the class.
It'll only cost you a lot of money.
Extra
and I didn't even punch holes in it. So it's clearly different. But this is what I'd like to conclude. And again, I hope that this is a, if you're interested only. This is what I hope it will be an ongoing discussion. Because what I'm interested here is not pontificating on esoteric points. I'm trying to bring together what's going on in our world. Rabbi Goldberger's summary and application. That which is within our world, we can grasp internally. Within our world means we just know it so well. That which is beyond our world, we can grasp only externally through our seichel. Indeed, Hashem gave us the ability to internalize some aspects of spirituality through the performance of mitzvot like Shabbos, which we do with our entire beings, including our emotions and our body. Shabbos is real. You can taste it. However, and that's great because that is an access to spirituality which is tangible in this world. It is the number 7. It is higher than the number 6. 6 is just natural. No spirituality at all. 7 is a higher, it's spirituality, but it's spirituality which is limited. It's the kind of experience, it's the spirituality of eating cholent. It's the spirituality of taking a nap. I mean, these are very internal, but also very worldly things. So it's limited. Torah study opens up a new realm for us. We can reach into the realm of 8, but be careful, because Torah study, by definition, is external. It is only through the means of our seichel. We don't taste our Torah study the way we taste our Shabbos. Well, at least some of us. Here's the real question. Is it possible to form an internal connection to that which lies in the realm of 8, the Torah? So, is it possible to get internal in the realm of 8 in this world? Yes. The answer is yes. How do I know? Because I know people. I have teachers that could taste Torah. Through the process, and this is my own connection to what we learned in once we quoted from the Tanya, actually. Chachma, Bina, and Das. These are three stages of learning. There's the initial knowledge, which is purely intellectual. Full understanding only comes when you work hard. You sweat over it. You break it down. You break your teeth, as we say. And you finally get it. That is starting to internalize the intellect because you have to sweat. And if you get full understanding, you will eventually develop a deep emotional connection to that Torah, to that knowledge. That's called Da'as. So we have the ability to work hard at Torah. That is the beginning of the process of internalizing. And then, in order to make the otherworldly descend into this world, it takes nothing less than an act of God. And just like God breathed a neshama into us, a spark of otherworldliness into our physical bodies, He can breathe Torah into our bodies. And for that, we must pray for siyata dishmaya. We must pray for Hashem's assistance because we're asking for an act of God to make otherworldly spirituality become part of our bodies. We can internalize the otherworldly spirituality to the point that we can taste the Torah much like the way we experience Shabbos, but in the higher realm of it. Doesn't it explain a lot of things? Is that what I heard you say?
Yeah.
That's why I'm talking about this. Because it explains a lot of things. It explains, my dear friends, how people can study Torah and not be transformed. It explains why some people say, gosh, he studies Torah, and yet I'm a bigger mensch than he is. So go figure that out. And the answer is very, very clear. You're a mensch in all the things that you internalized from your parents and your grandparents. And you would not even think of compromising on that. These people, maybe they didn't have such loving, endearing parents that taught them the manners that you did. Rather, they studied Torah. But studying Torah is intellectual. Intellectual doesn't become internal unless you really work at it. And how many people do that? How many people are capable of taking something from otherworldly and make it part of them like what their parents taught them? So everyone has an advantage. The people that have those whatever small amounts of wisdom or menschlichkeit drilled into them from their youth, they are so fortunate because that's part of them. If they have Shabbos, they've got a tremendous portion of spirituality in this world. But they may not necessarily be able to grow beyond that. They may be stuck because they're not endeavoring to reach out into the realm of Torah. On the other hand, the other people have an advantage and a disadvantage as well. They're reaching out to a higher realm, but if they don't internalize it, boy, it's going to look bad. The thought question I have as we leave is, how do these ideas interrelate to the class we had on Parshas Chayesara, in which we learned about the Maharal's definitions of Zachar and Nekeva, the different aspects within man? Do we have these two aspects, perhaps, in order to maximize both the internal and the external aspects of our being? That's for further thought. But thank you.
Very nice.
Thank you. John and I are doing a thing with Rabbi Kellerman online.
Yes.
And it's about changing.
And Rabbi
Yerucham
Levavitz,
who got it from. Who got it from, not directly, from the altar from Kelm, who got it from Rabbi Sol Salanter. Who got it from the Vilna Gaon. Who got it from Moshe Rabbeinu, I mean.
From his wife.
We talked about that.
Well, I'm sorry. Let me just finish that thought.
The whole thing about changing yourself. And it starts out by saying, the only way you can change ultimately is through Hashem's will.
Yeah.
Hashem's wanting you to change.
Yeah.
Because it's so difficult, we're doing something. We're doing something that isn't natural.
Right, right. It's not in our realm.
To do it is to pray for God. So we'll go through the steps that it takes to get to the point where we can get there, and it's taking 3 or 4 years. Literally, it's just.
So you come back to the main theme, which is Harav Kesher.
Stored in both.
Faith.
Wisdom. If I could, before Dina, just to bring it full circle, because you started talking about how people argued with Rambam. In other words, I didn't tie it together, but the way to pierce the externality of Torah into the internality of Torah is very much related to the way we pierce through the human intellect of knowledge and the internalization of knowledge. In other words, if you are stuck on the intellectual approach to knowledge, it's going to be very hard for you to accept those supernatural ideas which are not within the natural realm. You will be very clear on the rational part of Torah. But once you start talking about faith and all that, how are you going to be accepting of that if you're still on the realm of intellectual? So you almost have to work on yourself at the same time as you're studying the Torah. We have to work at becoming more internalized people, and then we can and embrace a more internalized view of Torah. But you're not going to take that. That's what we learned on Hanukkah, is that Torah and human intellect clash. Because human intellect is limited by human experience. Torah is otherworldly. How do the two meet? By deepening one's ability to internalize himself. And then it's like a duel. That's why in yeshiva you learn and you work on yourself. Those are the dual approaches. You learn Torah, but you also work on softening your hardcore intellect into becoming more internal. And that impacts the way you accept Torah. Dina.
Well, maybe you answer. I was going to ask you, you said at the beginning that this was a talk by Rabbi Becker dealing with Hanukkah.
Yes.
And I wanted to ask you, how to detail this to Hanukkah.
No, I didn't say that. He says that Hanukkah is eight candles, and therefore Hanukkah represents eight. So he says, how does Hanukkah represent eight? He really asked, how do you get to anywhere in eight? And he said, what he said was, if I recall, it was a very long lecture, what was special about the Jewish people at the time of Hanukkah is that they were moser nefesh. They exercised self-sacrifice, meaning they could have had an easy life and followed the Greeks and given up their Torah. Those few who said, we are going to fight till the death to hold on to our Torah, even though it is contrary to Greek culture and Greek Hellenism and rational thinking, by doing that, they're actually going against nature, human nature. And Hashem rewards you. When you go beyond human nature, He rewards you by gifting you that spiritual essence into your being. And so Hanukkah represents that the people, because of their self-sacrifice, were actually gifted a new internal perspective on Torah.
Very good.
That's why you circumcise somebody on the eighth day. Mm-hmm. It's a spiritual act that says there's more to the corporeality of sex than just the corporeality.
Now, that's curious, because one would think after this that would have been sufficient to be in the realm of seven. Because seven represents worldly spirituality. Just like Shabbos is seven. It's spirituality, which is very much perceptible in the world. You don't have to... You know, theoretically, it's not a requirement to study Torah in order to observe Shabbos. It's something that's nice to do on Shabbos. But Shabbos is really follow these rules, eat cholent, you know, take a nap, and you're spiritual. So one could argue that the spirituality inherent in sexuality would be a seven realm, not an eight realm. That's a good question. I don't know the answer.
What is a deeper
continuing conversation?
Yeah. The word chinuch. I know it's education, but I mean, like, there's
It's a dedication.
Different kinds of education, too. There's an education like intellectual learning from the, or learning deeply. What is the essence of Hinuch? And maybe that's a connection with Hanukkah that brings out the eight.
In other words, Hinuch can't be just education, the imparting of knowledge. Because that, if that would be true, if chinuch was education, then we would just be imparting knowledge, which would never be able to penetrate into the internal recesses of man, and thereby that means that chinuch must be the process of helping that student or child internalize it. So it's therefore by force it must be more than just imparting of knowledge. Is that what you're getting at?
I'm wondering if that is in the word.
Chinuch is dedication. It's not education.
It's not education. It's dedication.
It's for sure. I mean.
Oh, because Hanukkah
is the what did they do in the temple? They rededicated the temple. They took the temple that had been desecrated. It had been profaned. They got rid of the impure. They brought in the pure, and they rededicated the temple. That's nothing to do with education.
Thank you.
So when we're doing chinuch to a child, we are setting them up for spiritual success. All right. Shkoach.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.